bullying.
The Me Too movement against sexual harassment.
Toxic masculinity.
Is this the best a man can get?
When controversy erupted around this ad for men's razors going into Super Bowl season, we thought we were in for a whole slew of commercials, tapping into the momentum around social justice and equality.
What I actually think she's trying to say.
Making the same old excuses.
Boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys.
But something finally changed.
Allegations regarding sexual assault and sexual harassment.
And there will be no going back.
But this year's crop of Super Bowl ads did kind of go back to a more innocent time, with ads full of nostalgia mixed with fear of robots, and yes, some political ads that were tamer and subtler than a lot of us might have expected. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about last night's Super Bowl ads and how the tensions around politics and identity were either present or absent. Was the silence deafening? Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in. That's 816-235-2888. My guest panelists in studio are Aaron Randall of the Kansas City Star. Hi, Aaron.
Hello.
Sean Hammontree, a musician and video artist who is also a recovering industry insider. Is that fair to say, Sean?
Nicely, yes.
We're also joined by a really big player in the advertising business. Steve Bernstein is the president of Bernstein Rain. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good. So, you guys, I have thoughts, and I will share them, but you go first. I want each of you to briefly answer the question I asked our listeners. How did you personally see the tensions and divisions around politics and identity reflected or not in this year's Super Bowl ads?
I felt like there was a lot of kind of temerity in the approach this year. In a word, it felt very innocuous, like not very unprovoking. And I think that was purposeful. I think it was kind of a response to the ads this year. I think they were a response to just the knowledge of how divided and how politically charged the society is right now. And I feel like advertisers took the route of kind of taking it easy this time. They didn't want to like lay it on a stick. I don't think I love the idea, but I understand the idea.
Sean, what do you think?
I think they were tame by comparison, and I think maybe
by comparison to last year, or just what we're seeing in general.
I think in general, because we're in everything, you know, outside of commercials is so high tension and saturated. I think that they were trying to put just humor, and more than even focusing on their brand, they were even using nostalgia to kind of tie the brand to, you know, something else, something that was more pleasant, probably to the eyes and ears.
Steve Bernstein?
You know, I agree with Aaron and Sean. What we needed this year was light humor. And they say the Super Bowl ads are a barometer of what people are looking for. And it was not very challenging compared to other years, compared to other events. It was very light.
Well, so as someone who works in advertising day in and day out, I mean, I feel like we have been seeing a lot of big corporations like Gillette, but also Nike sort of famously dipping a toe into this idea that wokeness, for lack of a better term, can sell or at least create some kind of brand allegiance. And then I guess by their calculation, enough brand allegiance with some consumers to make up for all the people they manage to alienate with a political message.
Yeah, no question that advertisers are looking to attract the millennial generation and Generation Z, and those consumers want to align with products and services that take a stand. And it actually started back in the 70s with the Marriott company that paired with March of Dimes. But probably the most famous one that people can relate to is the Toms brand of shoe wear, where if you buy a shoe, the company is also giving a shoe to somebody in need. And we're only seeing that trend increase and increase and increase as people try to reach millennials and Generation Z.
So do you think that what happened in last night's Super Bowl might be a signal that there will be a retreat from that more generally? Or do you think that it was strictly about the Super Bowl? This is a big crowd. Let's try to please the whole crowd.
I think that you're not seeing the trend about cause marketing in the Super Bowl this year. This was just about pleasing the broadest audience they could and the mood that the country was in.
There still were some attempts at some kind of a statement, although they might not have been the approached with divisiveness, like avoiding divisiveness, I would say. Let's start with the Bumble ad featuring tennis player Serena Williams.
The world tells you to wait, that waiting is polite. But if I waited to be invited in, I never would have stood out. So make the first move in work, in love, in life. And don't wait to be given power. Because here's what they won't tell you.
We already have it.
You know, I found this very powerful. I was honestly like, I got a little bit of a shiver with that whole, we already have it, because usually so many attempts at empowerment messages are about what you haven't gotten to do in the past, you know, and just this idea that you have what you need, and that Serena Williams is this example of having that knowledge and what you can do with that knowledge. What do you guys think about that?
I thought it was an excellent commercial. I think that what the Super Bowl or what these ads did that I really liked was there was a very constant theme of inclusivity. And I think that they really noticed and they acknowledge just the rise, I think, of kind of like this new feminism, right? This women's movement, and women are really feeling empowered right now. And who better to, and you know, kind of embody that than Serena Williams?
And like, I understand, too, that it was an all-female team that created this ad.
Yeah. You know, this is a trend that, as Aaron mentioned, is undeniable, that this was not the GoDaddy Super Bowl ads anymore. This was acknowledging that half of the audience is female. It's respect for the female audience. This was a product that is specifically for women.
Would you say this is also about the advertising industry on some level, women in the advertising industry? I ask that because I have learned in getting ready for this show that the advertising agencies, like, it does seem to be a very white male industry.
Yes, we're supposed to talk to America, so we should look like America, but unfortunately our industry doesn't. We're trying to make moves to be more inclusive because we need to be. And there are not enough women in leadership positions in agencies, although that is changing and hopefully will change rapidly.
And do you think that an ad like this kind of is an agent of that change? Like, we're going to create a Super Bowl ad where everyone who works on it is a woman.
Well, this is the biggest advertising stage you can have. So, you know, I do think that it'll be something that people will emulate. And yes, it was created by women and produced by women, of course, starring Serena Williams. And it was very empowering. Mm-hmm.
This is a very different approach to feminism and gender politics in advertising than the Gillette ad we heard earlier.
Yeah, and with the Gillette ad, it's sort of a, it seems like it's sort of a sticky wicket because it's a powerful ad. The message is obviously immensely important right now, and at the same time you have the degree of people that are also going to criticize it, because at the end of the day it's still a product that is making a commercial. So some people have the question of, are they abusing the topic for the sake of their own notoriety?
Yeah, like triggering people's deepest pains and memories for the sake of selling razors.
Yeah, like, are they using a brush, you know, like the Me Too movement, let's say, is it one giant paintbrush that's being used on everything, and is it actually helping not only the message, but the brand of the company, let's say, or something like that? So
and I think
it's
the
interesting
jury's
time.
Still out on that. I tried to look up whether there had been any, whether you could see business results from this ad that Gillette aired. It was last month, and so far it looks like the business has been unaffected one way or the other.
Yeah, well, they already had that. I mean, they were in a position where I would love to have actually been in that meeting, because someone thought of the fact that they already have the motto, the best a man could get. You know, there's a beautiful attachment, you know, an ironic attachment to the message of that spot they did.
Well, so we've talked a little bit about gender and inclusivity, but the inclusivity message was broader than gender. I mean, first of all, Serena Williams is, you know, seen as a champion of her gender, but also of her race.
Absolutely. I think that, and what I appreciated yesterday was the approach. I think that these messages were deliberate, right? But they had much lighter strokes than what we're used to seeing, or at least what we've seen the last few years. I think of I think it was 2 years ago when was it Budweiser that had the immigrant story of Anheuser-Busch, and then them singing America the Beautiful in all those different languages, and the Spanish speaking families meeting this border wall. It was clearly a response to, our fears, trying to say we're better than this, right? But now I think that they kind of just realize that, tensions are, or they made the choice to want to calm tensions more this time around. And I think that it was interesting seeing that they chose that for the Super Bowl, and they kind of let the more charged ads kind of rain during before Super Bowl. You had the Gillette ad and the Nike ad. Those ads kind of got their shine before Super Bowl, so that we could all talk about it on social media. But in the biggest spot, they kind of took a more softer approach.
Do you think that those? I mean, the Gillette ad was really specifically online, and it seems like the play that they intended to get on social media was part of maybe the whole plan. Whereas Super Bowl ads, maybe it is about this moment where everybody does kind of watch. Because there aren't a lot of moments in television where everybody's watching other than the Super Bowl anymore.
That's what I felt. Mm-hmm.
And it's probably not as much now because the ads are usually, they hit online a day, maybe even a week before the Super Bowl. Whereas in the past, that was why everyone tuned in, because
you wouldn't see them until
game night.
You've also brought up an interesting point about being more controversial outside of the show. And not only that Gillette ad, but there was a new product launch for Devour frozen food, which was comparing it to an adult addiction, pornography. And I thought it was a great ad, but it was certainly much more controversial with the uncut version that they showed online before the Super Bowl.
And then they reined it in a little bit.
They reined it in a little bit.
Well, so another ad that kind of approaches inclusivity in a really, I felt, different and refreshing, poignant way was this. There's a We All Win ad, and we'll hear it in a second. But with the Super Bowl being the display of sort of classical, masculine, athletic, physical prowess, an ad like this. This one is dealing with children with disabilities who want to be able to play video games as readily as their peers using a controller that's created for them. The idea of we can all play in the context of the Super Bowl, which is such athletically the elite of the elite of physical prowess. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. What do you guys think about that?
Well, this one was definitely a showstopper. It was one of the ones where when it came on, people were silent. And I think it was touching. I think showing the parents emotionally talking about their children who had mobility issues and that they could play on an equal field.
Well, let's listen and then we'll talk some more. This is We All Win.
What I like about the adaptive controller is that now everyone can play.
I don't even have to look at the controller and just be clicking at the screen hey, yeah.
You never want your kid to feel like an outsider or an other.
One of the biggest fears early on is, how will Owen be viewed by the other kids? He's not different when he plays.
And of course, I did have to include the dad crying. What do you think about this approach and just... Yeah, Aaron, you said earlier that you felt that inclusivity was sort of a broader message of these ads when you put them all together.
Yeah, and even in a more just simple and a more capitalistic sense, isn't it just smart business to be more inclusive? There, when you make more people feel like they are seen by your brand, in this case being the Super Bowl, then you get more eyes, you get more money, right? And I think that it's also salient because you have Shaquem Griffith, who the guy who plays for the Seattle Seahawks, I believe, who has a physical limitation, doesn't have his left hand. And I thought this was one of the best messages, one of the best commercials of the night. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk, though, about some of the, like, I feel like inclusivity when it comes to bodies and, like, there was this message of empowerment and, like, hey, these are the top tier athletes out there playing, but, like, all of us, no matter what gender we are, no matter, you know, no matter whether we're big or small or whatever, like, we all are powerful. There was also sort of a retreat to, like, an old-fashioned kind of what is a body supposed to be? What is a body supposed to do? And how can we use that old message to sell a product? Let's listen to Olay Killer Skin. This is a horror scene where a woman is in an emergency situation with her husband, presumably, and she can't activate her cell phone because it does not recognize her face.
Let's go. Call someone.
I can't unlock my phone.
Here, you can't unlock your phone.
It doesn't recognize my face. I've been using Olay. It has totally transformed my skin. 28 days ago, I looked like that.
That's bananas. That's you.
Your skin's glowing. You could be a movie star.
Really?
I mean, no.
What do you guys think? I mean, maybe my feelings about this are what they are, partly that I am a woman sitting at the table and this ad is clearly supposed to speak to me.
I loved it. I mean, they used Sarah Michelle Gellar, so anyone who is a Buffy fan, like, probably, you know, giggled at that. There's that kind of humor, that Joss Whedon style of humor, I thought was in that spot. And it was done. It was well done. You know, the payoff at the end and everything, the way they approached the product and everything. I thought it was clever.
See, to me, the interesting thing is a product aimed at just the female audience, Olay. In years past, you would have been shocked by it. You would have said, this is Super Bowl. This is guys playing football in the roughest sport. Why is there an ad aimed at women? But as we've been mentioning throughout this segment, that this is a more inclusive time, and this was a more inclusive effort by advertisers. And again, half the audience is women. So,
and it didn't take the message about non-aging skin too seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly. Like, I was – one of the things I thought about – actually, I think it was when I saw that commercial, or maybe when I saw the Serena Williams spot, was it was just not even a decade ago that a third of the commercials you would have seen were purposely women in bikinis simply holding the product in front of a giant truck, you know? And so now, like, viewing that and viewing, like, the topics and the styles and the direction of the current campaigns, it's kind of amazing.
Aaron, did you see any subtle inconsistencies with the inclusivity message, or no? You just thought, like, well done on the inclusivity front.
Not really. I don't think it was anything like a deficiency, so to speak. I think that they made very deliberate choices in what they wanted to focus on. I think it was about, you know, empowering women and differently abled people. Obviously, inclusivity can go many different ways. It can be race. It can be orientation. But I don't think there were any deficiencies, so to speak. I just think that they made a kind of a choice to lean in on certain topics, and they did pretty well on those.
Call 816-235-2888 if you want to get in on this Super Bowl ad review conversation on KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we will be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm talking today with some guests about Super Bowl ads from last night. We thought we were going to be talking about all the controversial ads that were using social justice movements to sell products. We did not see those, and we're talking about that now. My guests are Aaron Randall of the Kansas City Star, Sean Hammontree, an independent freelance artist and who has been in the advertising industry, and Steve Bernstein, president of Bernstein Rain. Hi again, everyone.
Hi. Hello.
So any final thoughts on theories about why we haven't seen so much controversy?
In the ads themselves? Mm-hmm. I just think because of how charged everything is right now. If anything, the Super Bowl was a nice 3-hour reprieve from the 24-hour cycle of insanity, really, and regardless of your beliefs or opinions, it's just a dreadful news time right now. And so I think really having some fun, lightheartedness, even for just 3 or 4 hours of a game, was probably very welcomed.
You know, I want to play a commercial, or at least part of it, one that I think has a subtle message. It is radical in its quiet, you could say, in a very overstimulating world. And that might be just exactly what we are talking about, in fact. Like, what was radical about this year's ads was how quiet and non-charged they were. But this may take it to an extreme. Let's listen to Michelob Ultra Pure Gold.
Let's all experience something together. This place, so pure. Beer, so pure you can taste it.
So, thoughts, commentary on Zoe Kravitz selling an organic Michelob Ultra Pure Gold?
Well, it was definitely a spot that zigs when everybody else is zagging. I do wonder, though, at a Super Bowl party, if you're surrounded by a lot of people crunching chips, yelling at the game, all those things, if this gets noticed, because it is so quiet. But if you're watching by yourself, soothing, different from anything else you're going to see.
I mean, sports are dramatically loud. And as I have been known to say, loud beats quiet. There's just, if one person's being loud and one person's being quiet, loud wins, period. Is this an attempt at, like, quiet's going to win? Like, playing this during the Super Bowl, that's crazy.
That was my thought was, if by the time everyone got quiet to watch it, it was probably over. Because, you know, like the whole introduction to the commercial, everyone's probably like, you know, everyone, never mind. It was a Michelob Ultra ad.
But when you think about, like, what we've been saying, that people feel like things have gotten, like, the volume has gone up so high on arguments and disagreements and divisions, and just that not only was the tone hushed, but there's also, like, we're going to experience something together, mm-hmm. is what she is saying.
Sure.
And, like, that is that a radical message?
Well, you can definitely imagine it in the planning meeting with the client, where they talk about the need to be together, the need to be different, the need to be softer. There's too much yelling going on. Let's not yell. I mean, you can imagine that meeting, and you can see how an ad like this could get created.
There's also, I mean, that this was an organic beer, that might be tied to this idea of what isn't in here is what matters. So we've taken out the volume, and we've also taken out whatever, like, ingredients, harmful chemicals or practices that we wouldn't want to include in our pure, pure beer. Mm-hmm. But that message came up again and again. If a political message came up sort of unexpectedly a lot, I would say it was that one. There was the Budweiser ad that had Bob Dylan in it singing Blowin' in the Wind, where Budweiser is trying to reach out using its Super Bowl advertising dollars to sports fans to make sure that they know that Budweiser operates on wind energy. Mm-hmm. This is very 2019.
Yeah.
Very 2019, but nothing controversial about wind energy, is there? So again, pretty safe, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sustainability was in a few commercials, right? Wasn't there a few electric car commercials
also?
Yeah, tons. That kind of tapped into that.
Mostly are just music, let's be honest, so I can't play that. Right.
So again, it's just, to me, I think it's a clear decision that these advertisers made. Like, yes, we're going to touch on these social and political stances, but we're going to choose the most innocuous ones that we can. We're not going to go on race. We're not going to go on immigration. We're not going to go on these topics that have already dominated the news sphere and dominated, you know, the conversation. And I guess
and
it's
we're
a
barely
give and take.
Gonna say it. Like, that's the, right. It was mostly music, and like there's a wind turbine in the mm-hmm. the Blowin' in the Wind one, but mm-hmm. it's just the words pop up on screen at the end, like brewed on wind energy or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, barely saying.
Yeah, like there was it. Like, they were deliberate, I feel, but they were not, like, they weren't provocative. They weren't trying, I feel like, to get They were obviously an emotional response out of people, but like the route that they took was interesting to me. And I think it was kind of jarring because you almost kind of watch Super Bowl prepare to like have a conversation or prepare to really like, you know, have a reaction. And I think that my reaction most of the time was just like, well, okay.
I also, one thing I think that I found interesting was in the past, a lot of these companies used Super Bowl to try to get name branding going, some sort of one line brand that would be stick all, you know, where's the beef, for instance, you know, or something like that.
Just a few years ago, remember Hyundai, they were like, it's pronounced Hyundai, like Sunday. And like, I never knew how to pronounce that word before that. And it, like, it worked.
Yeah.
I can say Hyundai now.
And those things would last for years. It became a timeless brand for these things. And now it seems like what they're doing, at least some of them, are they're trying to attach their brand to positivity in some way or form, whether, you know, it's this, like the Microsoft ad or something like that, or just something a little bit even more shallow. But everything is attached to a smile, so to speak.
And also, to be frank, I don't think the NFL's core audience, though obviously this was their biggest audience, their widest audience, NFL supporters have shown that, like, they really don't want to have tough conversations, to be frank. Like, they don't like, you know, to really lean into the hard stuff, so to speak. So I think that advertisers also know that. They know that, hey, a lot of people watching this don't want to talk about race, don't want to talk about X or Y or Z. So they chose the things that we could kind of all either get behind or not be offended by. Like, who's offended by wind energy, you know? Like, who's offended by, like, okay, maybe I don't care about, you know, Olay, but my wife does and whatever, I can get over that, you know, but they didn't want to do it. So I think that was a very deliberate kind of stroke on the advertiser's part.
Now, I mentioned earlier that it did seem if there was sort of like a dark undercurrent to these ads, it is fear of robots. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
A bizarre amount of robots.
Bizarre.
And that TurboTax one was just creepy.
Describe it.
Oh, it was the one with the robo-child. An inventor has created in his garage a child and trying to make it as human as possible.
It was bizarre.
And it was bizarre. And even more than bizarre, it was creepy. It makes me want to stay as far away from TurboTax as I possibly can.
Had a baby face on it. It was well animated. It was completely like it gave me the same creep factor as like a ventriloquist dummy.
Amazon had this weird Alexa ad. The title of the ad was "Not Everything Makes the Cut," and in that one, we're not playing it because the jokes are so visual. But an Amazon employee is confessing to her friend all of these things Amazon's tried to do with voice activation that have been fails, like the voice activated toothbrush, which is muffled in somebody's mouth, and then like the dog collar that dogs can use to order dog food, and dogs, of course, want to order way too much dog food. And then Harrison Ford, their owners, are of course always really mad about that. But it is weird that Amazon made fun of Amazon. Mm-hmm. And Amazon's big ad.
Better they do it before somebody else does.
And, you know, even though we're all scared that Alexa is listening everywhere, and that's what the ad showed, it also was the number two reviewed ad by the public in USA Today's ad meter spots. So this was the second most favorite ad in the Super Bowl.
So we're afraid that robots are going to take over. And maybe it's refreshing to see the companies that are behind that potential takeover acknowledging it.
Well, let's all laugh at it before it happens, right?
I guess.
There was even a Michelob Ultra ad that was a robot that was just so, you know, like two separate spots, and they were polar opposites of each other. You know, this over-enduring robot doing all these things, but it couldn't enjoy a Michelob Ultra. So it was sad. All the robots were sad.
Yes.
And in a way, this was very thematic in that, you know, robots, AI, it's about the future, right? Looking ahead. And I think that's what, you know, these ads did as a whole, was kind of focus on not now. Like, now kind of sucks. So let's think about what's coming in the future, what America can be, what we all can achieve, you know? I think that was kind of like the underlying tone for me when I saw some of those AI ads that I kept seeing all night long. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Let's talk to Stacy, who has called us from Olathe. Hi, Stacy.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
Yes. So I was surprised how unimpressive the ads were last night. But one thing I wanted to say was about the social commentary aspect of the ads. Anytime any ad sort of did have a social commentary, especially if it was an NFL ad, I remember even saying out loud, oh yeah, that's right, because the NFL just has such success in dealing with socially progressive issues. So I think, I wonder if that has something to do with it, because it's, you know, between Colin Kaepernick and the situation with the NFL, I just felt like anytime they tried to say something, it struck me as hypocritical.
So maybe they're trying to keep them, but the NFL does not, what role does the NFL have in, they don't vet ads, do they? It's through networks, right? Or am I misunderstanding that?
I don't believe they vet them. I imagine if there was one they were very upset at, they could stop it from running. But I'm not sure that that can occur or has occurred. But there's certainly a lot of controversy this year over the Atlanta Super Bowl and how the halftime performance would or would not be performed and whether it had Atlanta artists in it. And anyhow.
But when you if a company is talking about running an ad with sort of an ad that has a principle behind it or a message behind it, that is there that conversation behind the scenes of what holes could be poked? Like, are we in a glass house, so to speak, if we're going to start saying this message, what do we open ourselves up to? Does that conversation happen?
Oh, it absolutely happens. But you mentioned it happens in a bubble. And so often people point fingers out and forget to point the finger in. And that did occur last year. I can't remember the spot specifically.
At Ramat.
Was it where they talked about diversity, but yet they weren't being diverse? Was that the one?
Oh, no. Well, I was thinking about the Ramat where they had Martin Luther King doing a sermon behind it. And they got a big backlash from that.
Yeah, using
that. Can you explain the backlash?
People just felt that it was very ironic, especially given, you know, the protests and, you know, the NFL's kind of avoidance of the protests for a major company to use Martin Luther King's voice to kind of for this capitalistic reason. Right. And then some people even said that, you know, Martin Luther King was not a very big fan of capitalism, especially for, you know, what it did for black people or what it did to black people. So I think that advertisers definitely thought about that. That was in the New York Times the next day. Like, oh, Ram made of, you know, a big myth, so to speak. So I think people think about that and they just kind of decide to shy away.
Let's talk about what advertisers were doing for a moment instead of what they weren't doing. The celebrity cameo for the celebrity cameo's sake seemed big this year. And that's from, I would say, like a pretty time-honored tradition with classic Super Bowl ads. Toss in some celebrities, get people excited. It's like, oh, hey, it's you. Mm-hmm. I see you. Let's hear this Pepsi ad, which I think is like a good example of that.
I'll take a Coke.
Is Pepsi okay?
Is Pepsi okay? Is Pepsi okay? Ow! Are puppies okay? Is a shooting star okay?
Is the laughter of small child okay?
Pepsi's more than okay. It's okay!
Lots of celebrity power in that one. Aaron, want to talk about this?
Yeah, I like the mixture. I like how they kind of bring in a celebrity that you kind of miss in Little John, right? Little John was that celebrity that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that everyone knew. Black, white, old, young. Like, everyone knew one Little John song. You play Yeah Now, people still go on the dance floor, right? So they mix that with this voice that you kind of can't get enough of right now, which is Cardi B. I think that was a great kind of melding of both sides. And then Steve Carell just kind of gelled it all together.
And everyone got to feel kind of hip because everyone can recognize someone.
Right, exactly. Like, people really feel like, oh, okay, I'm in the conversation. Like, I think most people sitting around the TV could kind of tap into that commercial.
But then that is back to that inclusivity message.
Yeah, and a lot better than Kendall Jenner ending world peace, or
right,
or bringing world peace, I should say.
But how about the fun one too of Chance the Rapper and the Backstreet mm-hmm. Boys? Just a fun, just a fun ad and a fun mashup.
And the idea that now it's hot or whatever.
Well,
that kind of made fun of the Backstreet Boys.
No, it did, but it also made them cool though too, because here they are with Chance the Rapper. So it was just an interesting pair up.
I found the Stella Artois one kind of weird.
I did
what
too.
Happened?
I mean, it was Carrie Bradshaw from Sex and the City, and then the dude from Big Lebowski, Jeff Bridges, you know, the actual actors, and they come in and they order a Stella Artois instead of their trademark drinks, and it was just kind of, I don't know.
It's a little too niche, right?
It was way too niche for me.
Is the idea like these are sort of opposite types? Like, he doesn't care about his appearance. He's sort of like
It felt like getting out of your comfort zone almost, you know, like, okay, I know that you always order this, right? Sarah, SJP always gets the Cosmo, I believe.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
So she gets the Stella this time. And I guess in theory, I get it, but I don't think as you want to, and Steve, tell me if I'm wrong, you don't want to think too hard or like get it 5 minutes later, you know, or even 30 seconds. You want to get it then when you are seeing the ad. And I didn't always get that.
Yeah, you know, I felt the same way when I saw it. I thought it was, as Sean was mentioning too, that it might be too insider. But then I started thinking about the Stella Artois beer brand and who probably drinks that. Now, I haven't done the research myself, but it's probably an older, maybe a little bit more sophisticated audience who might know immediately who the dude is and Carrie Bradshaw.
True.
If that's the case, they were going just for that audience. And the rest of us, Aaron, I agree, we're sitting there going, oh, wait a minute, that's the dude. Oh yeah, that's Carrie Bradshaw.
Right.
But for their specific audience, I think it probably did play well.
Okay, so before we go, although I would love to end on a fun note, I'm not going to. I'm going to end with this Washington Post ad, which might be the exception to the rule we've been talking about. And this ad on the screen while this portion is playing is largely images of journalists who have died in their work with the dates when they were born and when they died. And this is what you hear.
When our neighbors are at risk, when our nation is threatened, there's someone to gather the facts, to bring you the story, no matter the cost.
So, why do you think Washington Post goes ahead and does this when everyone else does not?
Well, aren't they the ones who are standing up for free speech?
Yeah.
I mean, they really are.
Because they can.
Yeah.
I think also, that's a big reason because
really,
they can. 1,000 reporters almost or media members were laid off in January, right? People feel, I think that, and to an extent it is, news is this luxury, but you know, we're being hit hard by people not supporting journalism, or at least good journalism. And I think the Washington Post realizes that we're in a very dire situation. They are not, but...
I've heard that Washington Post employees are not unanimously thrilled that money that could have gone toward supporting the staff there went instead to a Super Bowl ad. But I hear you making an argument it goes to supporting journalists not just at the Post, but beyond.
Absolutely. I mean, even one of the journalists that was mentioned, Austin Tice, there is a kind of a huge poster of him in the Star. He's a McClatchy employee, and the Star is owned by McClatchy. So I think that, you know, the Dallas... Dallas Star, they laid off 40 employees, or Dallas Morning News, I'm sorry, 40 employees last month. So I think that the Washington Post, I liked it because it felt like kind of like a big brother wrapping its arms around me, you know, kind of like, all right, we know that we're good, but everyone else is like struggling out here. Let's go ahead and make and put this out here there, about how important the free press is and how much we need it.
Aaron Randall, Sean Hammontree, Steve Bernstein, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. You can tweet your commentary on Super Bowl ads. We are at KCURCST. Coming up, a spoken word poet has something to say to white police officers. Find out what it is in just a minute. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now I'm joined by Veronica Clay. She's a poet and spoken word performer who is a college senior, I believe, at 20 years old. So do the math real quick. You will realize that means she finished high school at something like 16. But that is not what originally caught my attention about her. Veronica caught my attention at the Martin Luther King Day celebration at the American Jazz Museum, and it was because of a poem she performed called Dear White Police Officer. We're going to talk to her about that poem now. Hi, Veronica.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
So you said during the performance that you don't normally give preambles before you perform a piece, but you made an exception, and I'd like you to make that same exception now, if that's okay.
Sure, yeah.
So you began by establishing who you are and how you identify racially and how that's shaped your attitude toward race, what race relations can and should be. Can you share that same information with our listeners?
Absolutely. So I am biracial. My father is African American and my mother is white. And so I have this very interesting experience of being two races at the same time. But that's something that's not a normal experience, I guess, or not very common experience because of how few biracial people are in America. And so that's shaped my perspective on what the world should look like because I have grown up in this home that's so full of love and acceptance, and the color of skin is irrelevant to the worth of a human being. And so my lens has been one of love and compassion for people regardless of the color of their skin. And so racial division itself is sort of the antithesis of what I believe the world should look like.
You performed this poem, and I want to go ahead and let you perform it before we talk about it. Can you give us your rendition of your original work, which you debuted at this event, Dear White Police Officer?
Sure. Dear White Police Officer, at my local gas station, I apologize. Mama and Daddy always told me to shake police officers' hands and thank them for their service, and I used to. Faithfully. I wanted to be just like you, even had the Dollar Tree dress-up kit as a kid, black baton, cuffs, a gun, and a badge. I played in the basement with my brother, told him to put his hands up and placed him under arrest. I did my best impression of you, the good guy. But I couldn't quite shake your hand today. Dear white police officer, clocking cars on 435 South, I apologize, but something changed. I was in seventh grade, and Daddy gave me the talk his daddy gave him. He told me that when the time came, I had to drive extra safe, find a place in the open to keep my wallet, always say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, keep my hands still on the wheel and never resist, even if I did nothing wrong, because it's not worth getting killed, and I have the right to a phone call in jail. And Daddy promised he'd always find me. Dear white police officer, at the academy down the street, don't worry. My daddy didn't teach me to be afraid of you. The news did. You see, my granddaddy grew up during the civil rights, but I grew up during the Ferguson, Baltimore, and Charlotte riots. And I watched the TV screens filled with scenes of burning buildings, cars, and screaming masses, breathing tear gas. The news taught me the term police brutality and that there was a divide between black and blue lives, and that mine didn't matter, even if I was a good kid who planned to go to college. Dear white police officer, eyeing me at the grocery store, Michael Brown is the first name I carried with me, my generation's Emmett Till, with a twist, teaching me that the moment I commit a crime, I lose my rights, and that I shouldn't give officers ammunition to shoot me with. Dear white police officer, whom I was too scared to ask for help from when I was being followed at the mall. Philando Castile was the first human I saw seconds from death. His white tee was soaked red in the blood drawn by the bullets of your acquitted fellow officer. I was 17. Dear white police officer who helped me cross the street, the first feeling I felt when Mama told me Daddy got pulled over a few days ago was relief because he wasn't dead. Dear white police officer who ticketed Daddy's car in our driveway for blocking the sidewalk, but didn't ticket our neighbors, I have a childhood best friend with a gorgeous smile and beautiful dark skin. He's gone away to college in California, and I'm afraid he won't come back because he's young and good and sometimes reckless, and I can't breathe when I think of what could happen if he gets pulled over by police and cops in attitude. My body freezes. A void opening in the cavity where my heart should be beating at the idea of losing him to you, the good guy. Dear white police officer who knocked on our front door in the dark of night to give us a piece of mail and enough adrenaline to run a mile, my brother brought home a pellet gun today, and Mama, Daddy, and I got mad. We didn't mean to hurt his feelings, but we had to remind him that he isn't like the other neighborhood kids who play with guns in their backyards, because having a black father with dreads makes bystanders question his innocence. Dear white police officer who drove me to the hospital, I am sorry if I looked at you fearfully in my delirium when I demanded my brown-skinned friend be allowed to ride with us. I knew you were just doing your job, but I didn't feel safe and didn't trust my shaking hands.
There's so much to ask you about Veronica Clay. How did you feel performing that at the Martin Luther King celebration?
I felt a mix of emotions. I felt a little bit of fear just because whenever you bring up such a difficult topic, there's a lot of backlash. And I think our country is so used to people fighting over issues instead of dialoguing over issues that I was a little afraid that people might want to argue.
Start fighting.
Yeah. And I was like, I don't want to fight. I'm not here to do that. So I was a little bit afraid, but at the same time, I felt also free because I was getting to express my emotions and my feelings in a way that I was hoping would open up conversation and not arguments, but just conversation, and that I could maybe be able to relate to people and start a dialogue that might be productive for our country.
You did want to be a police officer as a child?
Yeah, I did, actually. We had this set. It was from the Dollar Tree, but it was really impactful to be able to grow up and see police officers because they were my heroes. And even I went to like this training a few years ago, like self-defense, and I actually got an application given to me. They're like, you're great, we would love it. And I was like, I'm actually only 16, but I was excited. And I was like, yeah, you guys are really cool, and I would love to be able to defend the country in the way you do. But at the same time, they're heroes that I don't think I could be because of how difficult some of their decisions are that they have to make.
It's interesting to me that so much of the content of this poem is explaining the pain that you have felt seeing the interactions between specific white police officers, but then I guess a sort of succession of them and the violence that Black people have experienced at their hands. It is interesting that that's framed within an apology for your own discomfort with people who may be very different from those police officers. Mm-hmm. It's the apology piece of it is really interesting to me.
I think the apology piece is pertinent. Whenever you're talking about such a sensitive issue, to go into it with a humble spirit. And part of the reason I'm apologetic is because I am truly sorry that my relationship with the police isn't what it used to be. It's not that I hate them or that I dislike them, but I'm sorry that I am oftentimes afraid of them. I wish it wasn't that way. It's like, I wish I wasn't afraid of you. I'm sorry. Like, I don't want it to be that way. And I think that's pertinent to have that apologetic tone, because if you're really wanting to change something, it's usually because you don't like the way it is. And I'm sorry that I don't like it the way it is.
You know, you said that you wanted to start conversation, and something that obviously as a member of the media I kind of latched onto is that you said, I'm sorry it wasn't my dad who taught me racial division, it was the news.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about, the events themselves that you've seen on the news have changed your perspective in some ways? Do you think that the news could have presented those stories differently in a way that would have left you with something else?
Absolutely. So there are a lot of problems, I think, with the way racial division is talked about and discussed in the news. Part of it is like the common showing a mugshot of a person, regardless of if that mugshot has anything to do with the situation at hand. That is specifically for African Americans, is that a lot of times a mugshot will be shown instead of just a regular photo, even if that crime was years ago and had nothing to do with it. So there's that. And then there is this tendency to call things riots before I think they get to a point of being rioting, so protests, and you just say, oh, well, it's a whole bunch of African Americans who are angry, so therefore it must be a riot, even if nothing has happened to make it anything more than a protest. So I think the language and the images that we associate with African Americans whenever they are frustrated are crucial, because that's what America is looking at. And you're going to get into the stereotype of the angry Black woman or the angry Black man if you're not asking yourself, am I being neutral on this position, or do I have like a subconscious bias? And am I seeing these people through a different light because of histories of seeing people that way, you know, or am I giving them a clean slate and saying, okay, this is what's happening in the moment, you know?
When you talk about your friend who's gone to California and gone to college and that you can't breathe when you think about what he might do if he were pulled over by a police officer. Can you talk about that and your choice of the phrase, I can't breathe?
I didn't expect this question because it's really personal, but it's a good question. Basically, I grew up with him, and he was one of my best friends. And maybe he was a little bit more the more wild one of the two of us. But I think it's this idea of feeling like I'm suffocating because I'm so scared. And I'm like, and I think that feeling isn't so much now as when I was growing up and I started seeing these riots on TV and I started seeing these terrible things happening. I was just afraid for him, you know, just because when you love someone, you don't want anything bad to happen to them. So I think that was huge for me.
Well, our time is up, but Veronica Clay, thank you so much. And I'm going to keep an eye out for your work. I was really impressed.
Thank you.
Veronica Clay is the 20-year-old poet who performed Dear White Police Officer at the Jazz Museum's MLK celebration in January. Tomorrow, we will meet with a researcher who's looked into how job and education outcomes are affected by having a white-sounding name, no matter what your actual race. That conversation tomorrow at 10. If you missed anything today or last week on this show, we keep all our conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. So head on over there if there's anything you'd like to catch up on. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Chris Young, Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.